Welcome to the Leadership Show. If there was a time for conscious leadership, that time is now more than ever. The Industrial Revolution undeniably shaped the modern world. It gave rise to incredible advancements and progress, but also left us with unintended consequences. Sustainability wasn't part of the conversation, whether by oversight or by design. And now we face the challenge of maintaining the modern world we've created. Today, we stand at the dawn of a new era, the sustainable revolution. This revolution calls on conscious leaders, leaders who understand that our future lies in creating shared value for the planet, people, and of course, profit. This is what we refer to as conscious capitalism. In these episodes, we will be unpacking the essence of leadership for a sustainable future. We'll have critical discussions on how we as leaders can move beyond short-term thinking and focus on the core principles that will secure a future that is resilient, inclusive, and sustainable. Join us as we explore how conscious leadership can drive change, foster innovation, and ensure that the decisions we make today can lead us to a future we all want to live in. It's not only our special guests that are joining us today, but we also want you to shape what goes out in the world. Because you see, we're doing a live podcast recording today, and I will share a little bit more about that. But before we get started, for those of you that don't know me, I'm Carmen Murray. I'm the founder of Conscious Lead HERS. Now, the HERS and Leaders stands for Human Empowerment, Responsibility, and Sustainability. And we are all about being change agents, and we are all about storytelling, and we are all about moving this movement from boardroom to living room. But today, where you find yourself is that we're going to start taking this movement, not just what we're doing online with the podcast and all the activities that we're doing with conscious leaders and the community, which is over 7,000 women. And this is just over 18 months. And I think we've spent like 600 rand advertising. I'm just saying. So, you know, as a marketer, that means something, because I'm in that stage of my life where I'm like, it's not about vanity metrics. It's about impact metrics. I want to see impact in the world. And it starts with me. And I decided to start this journey and see who comes along with me on this journey. And I'm so honored and blessed to have so many wonderful people joining me on this journey. Some days it's hard. Some days I have emotional breakdowns and cry on WhatsApp to people like Bronwyn. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm seeing all these things happening in the world. And I don't like what I'm seeing. But my whole belief system is that as much as we're seeing all the volatility in the world and we're seeing toxic leadership, we have a choice, and leadership is a choice. And so we can resist by building something better and building something hopeful. And for today, I really want us to dive in. How can we prepare for the rise of Africa in the age of AI? You see, we are now in a stage where we can't wait until tomorrow. We can't wait for 10 years from now. Today is the day where change begins. Every day is the day where change begins. And what can we do? And this is why I'm honored by the guests that will be joining us today. But before I get started, I want to kick off by thanking our sponsors, Edelman Africa. First of all, thank you so much for this venue. And when I couldn't believe it, right? I sent an email to this woman, and like within a few seconds, yes, we're doing it. And I was blown away by how spontaneous and caring and loving you were. And you were just like embracing us with full arms and seeing the vision before you really understood what was going on. So I want to say thank you so much. And then also to Chloe. I don't know where Chloe is in the room. I just want to say thank you to Chloe. She's been such a phenomenal force in the back end and helping us to arrange all of this. I don't think when we put events together, like, I don't think, especially in these times where people are overprocessed and exhausted, and it takes 10 weeks to get one answer out of a person. But I'm so, so grateful that everybody that's here that's showed up, we're so honored and so privileged. So thank you so much. And then without even, I mean, you know the story. I talk about Solid Gold Podcast Studios all the time. I've actually started podcasting because of Sam Marshall from Social TV, who's also here with us today. we were at a heavy chef event. We were at a heavy chef event. And he said to me, don't you want to start a podcast? And I just did a 3-month road show on brand fundamentals and how to build brand purpose. And he said, this is such a great conversation. Don't you want to start a podcast? And the next day I started podcasting and I was like, what is this? What are we doing? And then I joined Solid Gold Podcast Studios. And 8 years later, I've been podcasting for so long and we now have an audience in over 50 countries. And I must tell you, I don't have a formula. I just go in and have fun. And that was always the thing that I was going to do, was have fun. But in this time, the past, I would say 3 to 5 years, a lot of things have changed. The world has changed. Society has changed. Business has changed. I have changed. You have changed. And I want this podcast to represent who I am as a person. And I decided, okay, I'm going to start opening up the podcast so that we can actually have more female voices and hear more female voices, because it's becoming harder and harder to find women in the age of AI. Because when you go and look for speakers, the output that you get is, yeah, mostly male. And so how are we going to build AI visibility for us as women? How are we going to start rising up? Because you see, I am a marketer and I always talk about this. I consider myself a futurist, but I want to translate culture into growth opportunities. And that's what I do with my clients. But for me, what is important is to understand the importance of what shapes culture. And here's the things that shape culture. Women. Culture goes where women goes. 85% of global spend is influenced by women. And so we really need to have tough conversations amongst ourselves around the state of the world, what we're seeing and what we need to do and what we can do, and to step into our power so that we can be that change that we want to see in the world. And then the other one is marketing, because marketing also shapes culture. And the interesting thing is that marketing is actually the mirror to culture. So we look at all of the consumer's behavior. We look at everything that they do, and then we try and find technology, and we try and find what kind of behaviors are happening so that we can serve the needs of the consumer. So where consumers literally go is where the world goes. And this is something that is in my work that I do, is how can I change the storyline that happens within our industry, but also what happens with women, and how can we bring the women in our community, which, how do we bring them in that we can build with them and co-create with them a better future and have round tables with them and bring them to the forefront to bring their ideas to the table as well, because we can't do this alone. So for the past 3 years, I've been working on this thing called authentic intelligence. I woke up one day and I realized, in a world of artificial intelligence, surely we should be focusing on authentic intelligence, because the world works in dualities. And so I started going down this rabbit hole and studying it for 2 to 3 years and really trying to understand what authenticity is. And if you really want to talk to me about it, I can go really geeky into that conversation. But what has come out of that for me is the 7 intelligences that we need in order to shape the future and to build our own authentic intelligence. And the first one is creative intelligence. We don't only have to pay attention to our own creativity, but we also have to pay attention to the creativity that's happening in the world. Is this innovation really shaping the needs of what we need for the future we want to build? If you look at Japan, Japan plans for the future 100 years in advance. We in society are planning 3 months in advance because we're following the next stock. We're following what's where the money is going. But are we really thinking of the future that we want to build? Because right now, in the state that the world is in, you will inherit the future that you don't want. And it's coming faster and faster and faster. The other one is collective intelligence. And this is what this room is all about. And bringing different minds, multidisciplinary thinking and ways you look at the world, and bringing that together so we can have robust conversations. Robust is actually a word that is banned in America in research, by the way. Just thought you should know. There's 350 words that are banned, and one of them is robust. One of them is female. One of them is racism. There's amongst many other words. And that comes with severe consequences as well in the future of research and and how culture will be shaped. Then we've got culture intelligence. Culture intelligence, really understanding what's happening in culture, because that shapes, it's the backbone, it's the zeitgeist of everything. And it's really important for us to really pay attention to that. And what I always say in our community is, geez, like, we have so many rich cultures, but how many of us can actually say that we know a lot about each culture in our country? How many of us actually invest to go out for the day, to go and learn from an indigenous Zulu woman and learn her story and learn her wisdom? Because you see, the world that we're living in now is all about information, but people are no longer seeking information, they're seeking wisdom. And so to bring wisdom, we need to really invest in culture and bringing culture into unity with our vision as conscious leaders. Then we also have to think about spiritual intelligence and what's the intent and the purpose behind everything that we do and how interconnected everything is. Because everything is interconnected. We just can't work in silos anymore. And so competition needs to change in how we embrace competition. We need to start looking at co-opetition. And how do we bring our different worlds together? Because we can't do this alone. You know, I look at AI in a very different way. I almost think about it as the jury. You know, when you know in America, when they go to the jury, there's like hundreds of, well, 12 or 10 people that has to make a decision on your outcome and what happens to your life. AI is just one person in the room, but it's the collective. It's the whole world's opinions about everything, good, bad, and the ugly. And so we need to stop giving AI too much power and also remember to dig deep into our own power, our own authentic intelligence, and match and mirror each other. And then we've also got emotional intelligence, because we can't build a future without emotional intelligence, because right now decisions are being made out of fear. They're not being made with executive states of mind. And if we really want to change the future, we really need to get into a mindset where we're making decisions that is healthy for the future and for everybody that's coming along on this journey. And then foresight intelligence. I have debates with our community all the time. I think everybody should be a futurist. I don't think it's just a few of us. I think everybody should really become a futurist. So when you make a decision, that decision that you're making keeps the future in mind and the potential future that we want to create. Is it dystopia? Is it protopia? Or is it utopia? We need to decide what that looks like. And so becoming a futurist and being a futurist is something that we need to practice so that we can see how we can take the future to a better place. And then there's curiosity. I don't think you can do anything without curiosity. And curiosity keeps hope in the room. And that's for me as a hope activist and making a lot of travel. I think that the time is calling us to have healers, to have restorers, to have activists, policymakers, people in the room that are willing to step up and brave up and speak their truth, speak their voices. In the time where a lot of people are being silenced to speak their truth, we must find ways that we can speak our truths. Sometimes it's not going to be online, but it's going to be in the one-on-one interaction that you're going to have with somebody in a room. And this brings me to what is happening in the world is the lack of leadership. And that's what conscious leaders is. I'm not perfect. I get a lot of things wrong. I'm trying my best, but I know I have people around me that keeps me accountable. And I know that people question me when I don't do things right and say, Carmen, have you thought about this? And I want accountable people around me. And the seven sins of leadership, one of them is myopia, short-sightedness. It is the love of power, corruption. And corruption is not just money. Corruption can be anything. And I think that we need to really, really look at if these sins of leadership is happening around us, how are we also doing this in our own spaces, because the seven sins of leadership happens to us as well. You know, and I want to close off with something that's very important to me is power has two choices. You can either have the love of power or the power of love. And in our day to day, that is what we need to decide. What type of power am I exercising in the room and where I'm leading? So anyway, I'm talking a lot. But I really want this to come across because this is the launch of the Future Fit Networking events. And as I mentioned, with this launch, what we're going to start doing is we are going to start taking this Future Fit Network event into buildings of organizations. And we're going to do almost like little road shows where we want to bring this so that we can actually bring what we are doing into the buildings and that we can start build the movement offline, not just online, because the algorithms are not in our favor. There's a lot of cultural gatekeeping. So I'm like, okay, I will outwit, outsmart, outshine this. All right. So please spread the word when you come across anybody. It would be so divine if we can bring this. And thank you so much for being the brave one that says, I want to do this. Edelman Africa and to your team. And yes, I just want to ask you, please, when the podcast comes out, if you can share it with your community and just be part of this amazing movement that we've built together with all of you. A lot of people have been part of this. And so thank you so much. And I have spoken a lot, but it's time to introduce the incredible guest. So you will find a lot of people around you or actually have been on the podcast or will be in the podcast in the future. And as part of the journey, because that's what we do. We take the conversations to the podcast. But there are podcasters here that has been familiar faces that are quite hectic when it comes to writing. They love writing books. I don't know how they do it. I'm still trying to get my first book out. It's like a nightmare. But anyway, I have co-authored for that matter. But with that being said, Mushambi Mutuma, I remember the day I had my first interview with him, with the tech adjacent. He drove in with a red Mercedes Benz, but not like a classic. I don't know. What classic was it, from the 50s, 60s? I don't know. But he came in there with suave. And all of us were just like, oh my word, what is stepping into this building? This is going to be so epic. And he sat in front of me and I just fell in love with his energy. So gentle. And always talking about technology in such a inclusive way where people don't have the shock effect, but taking them on the journey. And he's just launched, and I want us to give him a round of applause, his second book last month, which is The Adaptability Code. And he is going to come and talk to us about The Adaptability Code and what that is all about. Well done. Right. And then I will introduce you to our next guest. Once Mushambi is done, I want us to take it step by step, and then we'll fall in from there.
Please put your hands together for Carmen again. How's everybody doing? All right. I know we're a smaller room, but it's a real privilege to be here, and thank you for the time. It's certainly valued. And hopefully for the next 15 or so minutes, we can have a short conversation. I could tell you about my new book. And because school fees are expensive, go buy a copy, please. And give you some context to why I wrote this book and what it's about. As Carmen mentioned, I wrote my previous book, Tech Adjacent, about 6 years ago. And that book was essentially about trying to understand technology, how it works, how it evolves, and almost how to predict where it's going with considerable accuracy. And it did great. I'm really proud of that book. I'm proud in particular that all the case studies that we highlighted in that book were African. We didn't go to Silicon Valley. We didn't go to Singapore. We told African stories about tech's history as well as its future. And then my publisher said, when's the next book coming? And it took me quite a while to write the second book. In November of last year, I had another book finished. It was 90,000 words. And I was supposed to submit it to my publisher. And then something in me said, throw it away. And I threw away that entire book and started from scratch. And really what kept coming out for me was the power of adaptability. And maybe before I tell you that, let me just tell a quick story that I really like telling, and it's in the book. And it's a case study of one of the oldest cases of disruption and change that's ever existed. It's about an industry that existed for over 4,000 years, but within 20 years was completely disrupted and shut down. Any thoughts, ideas, what industry I might be referring to? If you made eye contact with me, ma'am, I will call on you. Any ideas? You can throw them out. What industry? 4,000 years old. Its products at their peak were worth more than their weight in gold. Literally $6 billion business at the time, but within 20 years was completely disrupted.
Coal?
Coal? It's a good answer. I haven't heard that one before, but good one. Not coal.
Emancipation Slavery?
Slavery? I haven't heard that one certainly before. I've done this intro a lot, but good one. Anybody else?
Finance?
No. Textiles getting maybe a little bit closer.
Okay.
Hospitality? No. Newspaper? It's always crazy how many different answers I get to this one. Okay. It is actually the spice trade. All right. So for millennia, the spice trade literally informed global economies. It informed slavery and colonization. That's a different talk. But essentially, this industry is informed basically on how to transport spices, because for a long time, human beings felt that spices kept preserved food and kept kind of bad food around longer. But what we found over time is that spices don't preserve food at all. They just make bad food taste better, right? And what it actually was disrupted by was the ice trade. So a man named Frederick Tudor was from Boston, Massachusetts, and he took these huge lumps of ice out of the lakes and rivers in Massachusetts in the United States and shipped them all across the world, from Calcutta to Bombay to India, literally everywhere. And we found that ice does a great job, of course, of preserving food. And then the spice trade started to shut down slowly, and evolution happened. A couple years later, the icebox trade came about. And my grandmother actually still has one in her home in Bulawayo, but a guy would come in once a week with a big hook, and he'd deliver a block into this fridge or a makeshift fridge. And then kind of convenience of having your own food at home was born out, right? Couple years later, 1940s, 1950s, the refrigerator was created as we know it. And then some of you, depending on your LSM and your income levels, you might have a smart fridge at home that tells you when you need to order some new milk, or when you need to make another run at Woolies or Checkers, or when you violated your diet. And then with some staff I've had is that a lot of people don't have fridges at all anymore, right? Because of rapid on-demand food delivery. Within 15 minutes, you can get thousands and thousands of cuisines readily available. The reason I tell that story is not one recorded business, despite making billionaires at the time, shifted from the spice trade into the ice trade. No one in the ice trade shifted into the ice box trade, not one recorded business. No one that was in the ice box trade, despite having route to market and product fit, shifted into the refrigeration space. No one in the appliance space has shifted into rapid on-demand food delivery. All these businesses have done the same thing, get you fresh food as quickly as possible, but none of them have evolved from their previous iteration. And the reason I start with maybe this story is that change, or rather success, is not based on how long you've been around. Despite the volume, despite the frequency, despite, I think Edelman's been around for 75 years, if I'm not mistaken, no longer how long you've been in business is a great marker for where you're going to be. No matter how successful you are, no matter the economics of the business, what got you here isn't what's going to get you to that next level. Carmen spoke a lot about change, and we're going through change rapidly, more rapidly now than ever before. And so when I was writing the previous book, I couldn't just give another take about technology. Technology is cool. Technology is great. I'm very much a techie, but your growth, your success is not going to be based on technology. It's not enough. AI. We'll have another conversation about AI from the two ladies that are following me. And just so you know, and my mother knows, I did say ladies first and Carmen said no. So, but I did try to to be a gentleman in the matter with the program today. But the reality is AI is not enough. Your ability to constantly evolve, constantly change, your ability to adapt is really what's going to be the future predictor of your success and your growth. And that's what the book is about. And in the book, we go through a couple of different frameworks about what it means to be adaptable and what the traits are of adaptability. And there's just five really quickly that I'll tell you about, and then I'll sit down. The very first trait is foresight. And that's essentially the ability to predict and look into the future. Bronwyn, of course, is the foresight expert in the room, so I'm not going to spend too much time talking about that. But that's the first muscle that we have to build when we're trying to be adaptable. And all of these things I consider muscles. I consider it a fitness program that you're trying to go through. Reading the book is not going to make you adaptable. Continuously training your body to be ready for change and evolution is what's going to do that, and forming this new DNA. So first, foresight is the first one. The next one is about resilience. And my father often refers to it as hanging in their nests. And for me, that's super important because now more than ever, change keeps knocking us down over and over. AI keeps coming. We launch a product or a service, and then next week, Sam Altman and the guys at ChatGPT launch another service that shifts and shapes what we were doing. And it continuously happens. So you now, more than ever, have to be able to absorb the knocks more often than you ever did before because it's so frequent. The third one is curiosity, and it's my favorite one. Carmen, you spoke to this a lot. And I don't know if there's anybody that speaks Italian in the room. Where? There, of course. All right, so you'll judge and see how I do. But my favorite Italian word is dimostrazione. Did I do okay? Ish. Of course. I can't hide the twang. It's there with me. But dimostrazione, right? So when you speak Italian, you gotta, of course, speak with your hands. So everyone say it with me. Dimostrazione. I love that. That was so godfather, godmother. It was perfect. You were ready, eh? Dimostrazione. What does dimostrazione mean?
To demonstrate,
right? As professionals, we are not great demonstrators. We're great implementers. We implement a strategy. We implement something that we've learned before. We implement a slightly better strategy than our previous financial year. We just implement, but we don't often demonstrate and experiment. And that's what dimostrazione is about. And that word was not coined by me. It was actually coined by Leonardo da Vinci, arguably the greatest mind of all time. And he said dimostrazione was the reason for his success, to be a great painter, to be a great mathematician, sculptor, literally jack of all trades, master of all, architect, everything, engineer. And he said demonstration, experimenting through demonstrating and trying, was the one key to his success. So that's the third lesson on adaptability. The fourth one is agility. And this one is super important because oftentimes we get bogged down by analysis paralysis. We want all of the information, all of the data. We want to get all the information before we make a decision. We want to sit in another meeting and discuss it, and we don't act. I read a stat the other day that said 90% of data in businesses goes unused, right? And that's often, as we know what to do, we know exactly what to do, but we just have a lot of fear and trepidation about making that final move. So agility is about moving quick, taking all of this data and then making a quick action. And then the last trait of adaptability is care. And this one was super important to me because of the extent of change. And this is a book primarily for leaders. And I think this chapter and this trait is primarily for leaders specifically, is that care now more than ever is super important. And this isn't me being airy-fairy or kumbaya. Care is the responsibility to guide others for their growth, right? If I care for this plant, I'm going to take responsibility for putting it in the best sunlight, for watering it according to its schedule, and I'm going to put it in the best soil for it to grow. And now more than ever, we need leaders that act with care. Not just empathy that says, I see where you are and I care about your feelings. No, I'm taking responsibility for your growth and transformation, and I'm going to put you in the best position to win. All those five traits are super important for building out adaptable businesses. And adaptable businesses, adaptable leaders also perform 5 times better than businesses that aren't. If I'm doing 5 times better than you, or you're doing 5 times better than the next firm down the road, we're no longer competitors, right? We're having a leapfrog of growth beyond you. And that's why being adaptable is no longer optional. It's a necessity. The second half of the book, as I close out, and not to bore you guys too long, is of course about technology, because I am a techie and I care very much about the future of technology. Is when I used to walk into rooms and try to sell multi-million-dollar digital transformation products, it would be very overwhelming for people for me to just jump in and sell them the tech. sell them the AI, sell them the platform. And so I had to start threading in some of these elements of adaptability to get them first on board with the mindset related to change and growth before we use the tools. And AI is the same, is that I could sell you all the latest and greatest tools of AI, but if you don't have the mindset for growth, the mindset for change, and you haven't unlocked that part of yourself, no matter how amazing the tool, it will never add any value. So the example that I often use when I talk about our relationship with tech is not Skynet and the Terminator. Like, robots are coming. Have you seen them? They've got guns now. They're doing backflips. You can't turn them off. They're speaking their own languages. What do we do? Is rather Iron Man and Tony Stark. And if you're a fan of Marvel comics, you'll know that the story of Iron Man and Tony Stark is this eccentric billionaire who's doing well in life. In the first movie, he gets kidnapped doing a mission in the Middle East, of course, and he gets put in the back of a cave and told to build a weapon. And instead of doing that, he builds this suit with a friend of his, and they build this suit to fight off all of these bad guys. He also builds this piece of technology called the arc reactor, and he puts it in his chest, and it literally keeps the magnets, or rather, it keeps the metal fragments from going into his bloodstream. So technology is literally at the core of his being, and it keeps him alive. So that's an important takeaway. But then he builds this suit and fights off the bad guys, and then goes home and builds a better version of the suit, and he becomes the superhero. The relationship I want you to have with technology, once you've been on board and understand change and you've gotten more familiar with it and more comfortable with it, you use technology as an amplifier and a multiplier. An AI is a literal suit that you put on every single day, right? It makes you Iron Man, Iron Women, Iron Persons, all protocols observed, right? It's the suit that you put on that makes you a superhero. It's not something that flies without you and without your control and without your direction. It's something that you put on to amplify your own capabilities and outputs. And that's a different kind of relationship with tech than the fear-mongering relationship that the media often gives us, that this thing is going to replace us, it's going to take away jobs, it's going to make sure that our economies don't grow. No, what do I use it for as an individual basis to be a multiplier and amplifier for my current capabilities? And I think once we embed that, we can have really different relationships, not only with technology, but with growth and certainly with success. So I hope that gives you a sneak peek into the book and what it's about and the value that it offers. Another key thing that we made sure to do is include frameworks that you can do as an individual and with your team in order to build out this muscle on a regular basis. So it's not just fluff. There's actual activities on building out your curiosity, activities on building out your resilience, on making your team more curious that you can do. A lot of them are available for free online on my website at mushambimutuma.com, but then the juice is primarily in the book. But thank you again for your time. Thank you. I really value it. And I value Carmen for putting together this amazing platform. This is just the next iteration of all of the big ideas that she has in her head. And I just applaud you, well, certainly for putting this together. But I applaud all of you for giving your time to commit to being future fit and to commit to that next level of growth. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. We're going to have a lot of questions, and I'm sure we're going to have an interesting debate as well. Okay. All right. Now the next authors, Surviving the AI Apocalypse. Quite a catchy title, quite doomy. But when you start hearing what we need to do in order to survive the AI apocalypse, the conversation becomes different. So Bronwyn, she and I met at a biz community event, I think the first time. And yeah, we've been friends since then. She's been coming to the podcast. I think you see her every 2 or 3 months. She's there. I've had the opportunity to be on her show now for the first time. I was like, yes, it's good. It was really fun. But I mean, one thing about Bronwyn is I can honestly say that Bronwyn is a woman's woman. She's always takes care and makes sure that all the women are taken care of around her. And that's what I applaud her. As well. And thank you so much for the women that you are in my life as a friend. Then also we've got Sharon Pierce. You're a recent addition to our world. And I must tell you, the moment you stepped into our world, my life just started blossoming. You are just such a ray of sunshine. You speak your mind. You are such a professional troublemaker. Let me tell you, you make me feel like I have to like go and work on my debating skills. I love it. But so much, things to think about in terms of this book. Now, what makes this interesting is Bronwyn is coming more from the futurist and being an economist perspective. And then you've got Sharon that comes from a HR perspective, human capital perspective. And then she blends in the thread of marketing and she blends in the thread of also understanding how this all intersects with also your consumers and building something for your culture, but also for the culture out there. And really understanding where the future is going is also just to understand how we need to design jobs for the future. And I think that that is one of the most interesting conversations to be had. I feel like there's not a lot of substance out there when it comes to the future of work, because I think we're all confused. We don't know where the hell are we going. What is the future of work? And we're all just trying to figure it out on our own. But I think if we can bring specialists in the room that can kind of like say to us, here's where you need to focus, here's what you need to do, then I think it makes it a little bit easier. So I thought, let us bring them in to come and tell us their story. And they've also just launched their book in August, which means that you are privy to the first conversations. Thank you so much.
Jesus, me right.
Yeah, amazing. All right, thank you, Carmen. Thanks for inviting us. Yeah, we're not shy. We're not afraid of being kicked out as the US or China. Shannon and I both say exactly what we want to say, and we'll not self-censor for anyone, which is basically why we've written this book. To counter some of the previous points, our thesis is that an awful lot of people should be really ready for Iceland of the future, but it's not the people that you think. Where you should be frightened about the future is if you are sitting on unearned privilege, just to sort of drag that out directly into the frontier. And if you do live in a nice house, if you got richer sitting on the couch during COVID in your pajamas and you thought you earned it, you might be in trouble. And that's really what the book is about, because two massive shifts are happening at the moment. The one is globalization and the other is automation. It's bigger than AI, but it's this idea that progress is always about doing more with less. And if you are taking more and giving less, then that means you've got to give something back to the market. That's the problem, where a lot of us earn very big salaries, have very nice, comfortable middle class or middle class plus, as I like to say, lives. You've got to kind of justify that in the face of automation that can do what you do better, smarter, faster. If you're not above average, as we say in the book, and you are earning above average, you're in a bit of trouble. The other thing you should be worried about, of course, is globalization, which, despite what the news will tell you about the multilateral picture breaking down, our economies are more entwined than they ever have been before. Money flows, and money flows to where it's getting the greatest return. And that means you've got to be as competitive as your cheapest global competitor if you want to remain competitive. And we have to really reckon with that. We think we can put our little defensive moats and our little tariffs in place, and that's going to protect us. But all that really happens is the bullshit, as we talk about a lot in the book, sort of piles up behind that moat, and sooner or later that dam explodes. And that's what the AI apocalypse is all about, really. The overdramatic title is all about the idea of this great big dam of bullshit about to burst. And some people are going to be caught swimming in very dirty water with their pants off. And other people will have the skills and the ability to defend the actual value they're giving to society. And the honest reality is most of us are taking more than we're giving in terms of value to society. And that's why, although you're not supposed to at these events, we wanted you to take out your phones and go to survivetheaiapocalypse.com and have a look at what we've got on there, which is a little test called a bullshitometer, which will tell you exactly how much value you are destroying and wasting in society compared to how much value you actually added. And that's the first reckoning in the book. For everyone to do this as an individual. What value are you adding to society or not? Be honest. You have to, if you care about the future, you want to change the future, you have to look at the present in the mirror. You have to look at your wrinkles. You can't squint your eyes when you look at that mirror. You have to open them wide and see. No, Sharon, put the glasses on and look properly. Look at where all the flaws are. Only then can you move forward and actually try and fix it. There's another test on that website, which is for institutions, for organizations, which is the deep work that Sharon really does. It takes a bit longer. You might need some help going through it. But again, even if you're adding value in a valueless organization, you're still at a huge amount of risk at the moment. So you have to reckon with that. But we don't leave you there. The second part of our book is all about how to become a solutionist, which is what we actually wanted the big title of our book to be. But the publishers was like, what is that? AI is much sexier. You'll sell much more with a great big AI on the cover. And being a solutionist is figuring out what value you can add and how do you deploy that value in context to solve a real problem for a real person. And here I'm going to hand over to Sharon to tell you a bit more about what the solutionist model really is.
Cool. But we don't want to sell models though, right? Because models are bullshit. No jokes. So I think, to Bron's point, I think I work very deeply and heavily in organizations, doing transformation and getting people ready for transformation. And really what we have written is not a book about AI and how to use it and how to make it be your advantage. We've written a book more about the I, which is what do you need to do to survive and add value and be remain competitive, which we believe is something you should be doing anyway. So if you have a job and you are just fulfilling your job description and you're not growing or doing things differently, using different tools, leveraging, I don't know, new insights and changing the product and service that you're delivering to whomever that is, then arguably you are perpetuating BS. If you are, you know, if I pose a couple of questions to the people in the room, how many of, well, how much of your day do you spend checking the work of others? How much of your day are you spending redoing the work of others? How much of your day are you in meetings talking about others?
Talking about meetings.
How much of your organization is led by managers versus individuals? What is the ratio of managers to individuals? And do you even know any of this information? What is your direct impact on the client at the end of the day? And can you chart that path? Or are you sitting in a job that is creating insights on PowerPoint presentations that no one's ever going to consume and that actually at the end of the day is just adding cost? And I think the reality is that solutionists are everywhere and can be everywhere. And I was having this conversation with Sam earlier to say that we live in a on a continent with solutionists all over the place. The dude at the robot who's irritating you or the dude with the, you know, sunlight soap spraying your windscreen who's annoying the crap out of you is actually adding value. At Springbok Match, you don't have a top. You're going to a party. You get one at the robot. When it's raining, you can buy an umbrella. You know, the bottom line is that that is value add. It's way better than adding a cost onto a product and service that somebody is begrudgingly buying because you are forcing them to save their money in an institution that you can only operate with a license, you know, or security who most of the time we don't really trust because we are in a crime-ridden environment and actually creating more crime creates more kind of profit. So we start to become so tuned to selling the wrong solutions for the wrong reasons. And that we are saying needs to shift. And AI really is just going to speed up and level that playing field out a little bit, right? So the bottom line is solutionism, as we say, we want everyone to become a solutionist. Think like a thrivalist or a survivalist. What is it somebody needs and how do we deliver that? And how do you really empathize with your client, whoever that is? How do you contextualize what they need and not sell things that are one size fits all, which many of us do? Here's a template, here's a model, here's a process, here's an approach. And really, don't bullshitify stuff with technology either, right? You know, we ask very difficult questions. Why do you have a complaints department? Why are we incentivizing the notion of complaints? Should we not be preventing them? And what in your organization is set up for prevention rather than for complaint? And are you really focusing on driving and designing the right practices and stuff? So, you know, an app... Yeah, it's sexy, cool, force people to become digital, do all of that cool stuff. But you still have the infrastructure of a banking branch. People still have to walk in there because you've got to pay for it. It's physical infrastructure. It is a fixed cost unless you're getting rid of it. And then what do? You force people to come in and then interact with the screen. Like, duh. You know, are we really thinking through the experience we're trying to create and what that feels like? Or we're putting technology onto problems that actually don't exist and creating more problems? And so the reality is really to just look inward. We believe solutionists are everywhere. Can you empathize, contextualize? Can you integrate and leverage data and insight, but truly knowing who your client is? Can you translate that data and integrate it in a way that makes sense? Can you ideate in solution for something that people want and need at a particular point in time? Or are you adding cost to the person who's buying? Are you a grudge purchase internally? I mean, if you're a compliance officer or a risk guy or a legal person, yes, necessary evils. But are you the person doing the audit and saying, you have failed? Or are you the person doing the audit going, you have failed. However, here's an opportunity that could maximize your value and change things. Or are you just by self-preservation following the process of internal audits, external audits, and following that mentality? It's not going to serve you well because an audit finding can easily be identified through AI. So if you're going to do anything, add value, then can you digitize, operationalize, and commercialize? Do you really know the cost of something and what cost is being passed on to your customer and value? And then can you learn, reimagine, and unlearn? The majority of organizations are probably overstaffed. There's a lot of your job that you probably, if you could, should ditch. And if we're truly honest with ourselves, the amount of emails we send, the amount of emails we receive, the amount of times we create problems for our staff or a process or a meeting or a manco, like, do you really need them anyway? What are you talking about in these meetings? You're talking about the customer or you're talking about the budget and how to save the cost? Is that taking away from or is it adding value? And so there's so much we can do as individuals to solution differently, as countries, as governments, to really teach this concept of solutioning. How do you design products and processes and services that matter for the people that are receiving them? And to Bronwyn's point about the shit water, plumbers are valuable human beings.
Because nobody wants the shit water.
No one wants the shit water. So if you are encouraging your peeps in your family, like my mother did to me as an Italian immigrant who came here not even knowing what a knife and fork was, you must study maths and science. Actually, no. Maths and science is easily doable through a computer. It's easily doable through the AI. You need to be able to offer value, which she did, incidentally, by feeding us and putting us through school by feeding others, so cooking for a living. Those are value items because they make you feel good or they make you feel valuable. There is an outcome attached to it. So last message, join the solutionist movement. Stop rewarding activity for activity's sake and start defining and rewarding outcomes. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Exactly.
Thank you so much. I think if our panelists, like Mushambi, if you can all join us on the front, we're gonna Sharon over here. Oh, okay. And while they are talking, I have to tell you the funniest story, right? So I went to the butcher to go and get peppermints for my dog, and there is this little 5-year-old boy, and he's looking up at the butcher, and he goes, "This plant in front of me, I just want to understand, is this real or is it fake?" And the butcher says, "It's fake." And the little boy says, "Interesting. If you just put loose stones on top of it, it could look real." I promise you, I was standing there. I almost wanted to go, mic drop, big aha moment. Oh my word. Do you just listen to what this little boy said? We are living in a world where we are always trying to make artificial seem real. And what we should be doing is the other way, is to enhance and use technology, but always stay true to who we are as human beings. All right. So before we get started, can I have the other mic? I would like for us to get a few questions to the panel before I get on. And just want to know who wants to kick off with a question. Kalnisha. It's gone dead.
Did I
need
answer?
Yeah, don't answer my text.
I don't really have a question. I'm going to think on my feet a little bit. I'm actually blown away by everything that's been said, particularly the solutionist movement, is the intention to create a sort of movement, a tidal wave of solutioning activities. How do you think this is going to play out for us? Or what's the best way this is going to play out for us, particularly on the African continent?
Yeah. So I think there are a number of ways. I think Bron and I have a real passion for how, organizations and individuals and even governments are facilitating learning or transferring skill. I was saying to Mushambi, did I get that right?
Yes.
And Bron earlier about productivity metrics and talking about, for example, how obsessed we are, and I'll use an HR example, but there are many, of how many learning hours or training hours did we deliver to our populations? And that's not the right question. Who did we upskill? Who did we outskill? Who did we reskill should be the measurement, right? And so I think our full intention is to create a solutionist world of solutioning where we can actually teach the practical capability building around solutioning and also get people in organizations to start advocating for and practicing it. And it's very distinct from design thinking and any of that theoretical stuff. One practical problem, let's take the data, let's understand it, integrate it, figure it out, create a solution. So I don't know that answers the question, but I think as Africans, we do it and don't sell what we do enough. I think we have so many social problems that we are solving in so many cool ways, whether it is, water purification or whatever the case may be. I think we have so many lessons to teach the world, and those are the things we actually need to advocate for.
Yes. I can come in from an African context again. Our big challenge in Africa and South Africa in particular is we have these shallow markets, right? Mm-hmm. We import things we don't need. We import things we need and we export things we don't need. We have these very shallow markets. We don't buy things that we make and make things that we buy. And because of that, our people are poor, right? Mm-hmm. And the other thing is when it comes to solving those problems, we solve them, no offense to other panelists, yeah, but with technology and with finance. We do financial inclusion, which just means like access to debt, which ends up going to a foreign company somewhere else, right? So we end up just perpetuating the same problems and not actually solving the real things. And when you start scratching the surface of the solutionist movement, you very quickly get to the real bedrock, that where the bullshit in our economy is, and isn't our financialized, abstracted, digitized, all the ized parts of our economies that moves things around or shuffles paperwork on the Titanic, as I'm calling it now, without actually solving any real problems. But it is good at sort of shuffling money within the same classes that we have, right? And I'm going to be very mean, but I'm going to pick on a local brand because we can't avoid it. You drive down the highways and you'll see all those pineapple adverts. This illustrates this to me perfectly, because I know this is, consciously, this is about the women's movement too. Does any woman in the room feel like those adverts are talking to you?
No.
Anyone?
No.
Anyone who's not a white man between the ages of 35 and 50 find them even vaguely funny? No. And that to me is a symptom of how shallow our market is, that a company is willing to spend that much money on that much advertising, talking to what works out to be, I think, something like 3% of our population. Only males and only white ones. That's how shallow the market is. But that's what they've decided they're going to invest in. They're going to invest in extracting money from that side of the market because that's where it is, rather than creating real solutions for real people to keep that money kind of moving around. And that's where the solutionist movement has hopefully have a real impact.
Yeah.
And that'll, as we start scratching through, doing the bullshit on for organizations for yourself, you will find very quickly that financialized abstracted, digitized economies is only exists because of the real economy underneath it. And that's where the real problems are to really solve. And there's so many to solve, as Sharon's saying. We have a surplus of problems, which means a surplus of opportunities, which can be solved by all the same brains that are currently solving only one problem, and that is how to extract as much money from this sinking ship as possible.
Mm. Wow. We've got another question, and then we're going to begin.
I think the other ads that are stupid is the naked ones as well.
I think they were written by the same white man.
Yeah, I actually like the founders of Naked. the first thing you said, Bronwyn, when you came on and you started speaking, is that you slightly disagree with Mashambi, right? So now my issue is you start your conversation saying, well, I slightly disagree with Mashambi about his viewpoint. You guys are the experts. So if you guys don't agree, how are we going to kind of weigh our way through what AI is in the next 3 to 4 years? So first of all, my first question to you guys are, do you agree on what AI will mean for Africa, number one? Because he says it's like an Iron Man suit. You're going, it's all bullshit, bullshit, bullshit. And then, so what, that is a question. But then I want to ask Edelman, because they put out the Brand Trust Report. Have you guys done any kind of thinking around what does trust in AI mean? Because obviously your reports are very insightful. I read them every year. I find them fascinating. But where's the trust barometer in terms of AI, and who's adapting to it the quickest? Because we now know, as we're sitting here, government is at the moment facing a litmus test, is Mkhwanazi, right now as we speak. And so I just want to get a sense from you as the kind of the guys who have built your value around trust. Where are we sitting with? We've seen a lot of work that Takealot has done in terms of online purchases. But I'm just worried that between Bronwyn, Sharon, is it Sharon? No. Yeah, between Bronwyn, Sharon, Misham,
so memorable.
The crap out of us.
No, so I don't think we're disagreeing. I think we're saying is that AI is a leveler. So it's bringing the bullshit to the fore, number one, as opposed to it is a core thing to go and AI-ify everything. The question is, don't AI-ify the bullshit. So don't think we're disagreeing. I think we're saying leverage technology to be your Iron Man, which means using it in the right way, not using it for the sake of using it. And I think therein lies the opportunity. So I don't think we are disagreeing. I think maybe just our semantics might be coming across as if we are. And then, yeah, let me leave it to the rest of you.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's been proven that I think the last study I saw said 70% of current business use cases around AI add no value.
They don't.
Right? So I don't believe AI itself is Iron Man, exactly. Iron Woman. I think your relationship with AI should be that, all right, of what it can do for you. But AI by itself, just the tech by itself, is not the be-all, end-all solution of everything that's going to lead to our next level of growth. And that's certainly not what I'm saying. I think our relationship with technology and how we use it as a tool for growth, that's what we need to shift and evolve and focus on. But outsourcing the thinking and the creativity and the credibility to the tools is also not adequate. And it's not going to lead to any kind of success. So yeah, I think we are saying it differently, but I think we're aligned. But I'd love to hear and understand a little bit more about the trust component, because I think that's the threat that happens right now, because people are outsourcing all of their thinking, and we've talked about this so many times, all their creativity just to the tools. They lose parts of that themselves instead of a clever prompt. Instead of saying, write this email for me, it says, I thought about it this way. What am I missing? What angles have I not thought about? What else? What are other people saying about similar topics? There's a different way to engage with the technology than outsourcing all of me to it. And I think that's what we need to shift in terms of usage of the tool, more than it is about the tool itself.
So I guess to further complicate it, there's AI, there's technology, and then I'm going to talk to you about innovation more broadly. That's what we've tested from a trust perspective. And last year, our whole report was based around innovation in peril. And we saw that less than 2 in 5 people trust the institutions in their countries to actually develop innovation in a safe and trusting way. Mm. So our perspective, I guess, talks about the environment within which all of these things happen. And the reality is that the individual, the consumer, all of us will only fall in line or accept, adopt, utilize, help with progressing things when they feel like they can trust to do that. So the inclusion piece is really important for people. If they feel like they're living in an environment where they are listened to, where they have an opportunity to contribute to these challenges when they're taken on the journey and they feel like it's open and accurate, then they'll adopt much faster. And then that's where you're going to see the progress. So only when it's an environment of trust.
Can I just ask, between Bronwyn, Sharon, Shovi, who's it about?
You kind of have to put them side by side.
They're figuring out.
You have one half of the other.
Sam, I'll give you one, okay? I'll give you one.
You could go have a preview of
both. We're going to open
buy them both and then give us the reviews and you tell us which one was helpful.
I believe in duality. Just saying. The universe teaches us about duality, and I think that's the journey that I am on. But I just want to get us on track again, and then we're gonna go and ask a few questions. So, something that's interesting. There was a recent report, I think, of over, and I'm paraphrasing, about 2,500 companies asking staff, you know, how are you experiencing that AI is, you know, adding value to your career, and 77% of staff said that they are less productive because of AI. Now, I want to give an example and illustrate that through a little story. So in 2021, the citizen comes to me and says to me, Carmen, we want you to predict the outcome of the municipality elections. I was like, oh, my career is going to be over before it even started. Like, I'm not a fortune teller, you know? And they gave me this task, and I had 8 weeks, and I had to go against all of these, like, you know, the research houses that are doing months in advance research, and here I have to go on sentiment analysis and try and figure out what's going on. And over these 8 weeks, as I was going through all of the sentiment analysis, I realized, oh my word, AI doesn't understand our culture. It doesn't understand our language. It takes something that's so positive and turns it into something so negative. So what I was doing was fixing sentiment analysis more than I was doing predicting. And then when I started doing all of the work is when I realized, oh my word, AI is a tool, but we have so much work to do in order to fix AI. And we can't just rely on AI to solve all of our problems. And you know what was interesting? By intervening and doing all of that work, we had an 80% accuracy rate with our predictions of all the coalitions of the municipality elections. Mm. And this is why it's important to note that AI is important, but you also have to develop your authentic intelligence. You also have to be very good, because technology mirrors human beings. And if you're not asking critical questions, if you're not developing your critical thinking muscle, then how are you going to be able to work with technology and then build better systems? So I'm going to start with the first question, because I think it's very important to note that we're gathering here today because I think we're all tired of seeing Africa as a pawn. We want to see Africa move in as a grand master. And if we want to see Africa rise as a grand master, we have a lot of work to do and we have to roll up our sleeves. And so I wanted to drive the message home as to what do we need to do to build the solutionist movement, to be critical thinkers for Africa. Because Africa, as you said, Sharon, has so much to teach the world. But maybe we are not understanding. Maybe Africa has its own imposter syndrome and we've forgotten our African values. We've maybe westernized ourselves a little bit too much and think that we need to be a certain culture in order for us to fit in. And it gives this whole idea of outsider effect, right? I'm an outsider. I know of many of you that are also outsiders where you just feel like you can't fit into the normal world, like, you know, a round peg in a square hole kind of vibe. And I think that this is exactly what Africa is going through in terms of what's happening in the world. And so my first question is going to go, many argue that Africa is behind in the age of AI. Is this a limiting belief or a strategic advantage? And how must our leaders adapt to shape a future that reflects Africa's unique realities rather than someone else's blueprint? So I'm going to start with you, Mashambi, and then we're going to move down the panel.
She asked a couple of questions.
Like a looks to focus from the heart.
No, it's okay. I'm going to focus maybe on the last one, is that maybe from an infrastructure standpoint, yes, Africa is behind because we don't own our own data centers. Mm. We're still relying and shipping these things literally across to other markets. So from an infrastructure standpoint, most definitely. But I think from a tech adoption standpoint, it's been proven from banking and financial services to mobile money, mm-hmm. is that once we get access to technology, we take it and run. And so I think that it presents a massive opportunity when we can deal with infrastructure, when we can deal with democratization mm-hmm. of content and tools for people, that there is opportunity for our growth. Other parts of the world their growth is single digit or it's percentile. And they're dealing with, Japan's dealing with the oldest population in the world. We're dealing with the flip side. We've got, I think we house, if I'm not mistaken, 12 of the top 20 fastest growing economies. We house the world's youngest population. So I think if we can empower this audience of people and capable minds with the tools, there's certainly room and opportunity for growth. But I think the infrastructure challenges, that's on a corporate level, on a government level, that certainly have to be fixed. But on an individual level, I think that, yeah, for me, I get more excited than if I was sitting in some other part of the world. If I was sitting in Spain or sitting in the U.S., I certainly wouldn't have this much excitement about the potential of the future that I have being right here. Yeah.
100%. Karina?
I agree with that. And I think being behind can actually be a strategic advantage for us. I kind of envision the lion we're sort of waiting to pounce because we know that there is a lot happening on this continent. And I'm almost hoping that we're doing it silently and then waiting for our moment. When our moment is right, I think we just can't show up empty handed. Mm. So when we have that chance, I think we've got to come, and that's our opportunity to come with our own playbook. And that, because that has to be reflective of our cultures and the demographics, et cetera. So I think we'll come at the right time, but I think we've got to come with our own playbook. Yeah.
Sure. Love that.
I'll probably speak a bit more to South Africa, and that is that digitization without that solutionist sort of playbook in your head is going to set us up for failure. Mm. Like, I'll speak very fairly about what's happening with schools. Like, our president is saying, teach the kids to code, get iPads into every classroom. Meanwhile, the richest parts of the world, and even the richest parts of South Africa, are sending their kids to farm school to pick eggs, you know, to like be real and touch dirt, right? And I think that there's a great push for the rest of the world would like to see Africa prematurely digitized, just like there have been questions around premature deindustrialization. It's tempting because then we will be set up to fail. We won't have the right educational mindset. We won't have the right skills. We won't have the right foundation to actually play that game without actually just being taken advantage of. We can talk about, and I'm very cynical about this, the successes of fintech on the African continent. Who are they really successful for? The rich. Who has that money now? We got a continent of people indebted before they were earning income. Was that smart, strategic? I mean, M-Pesa, yay, but who profited from that? You know, like who actually owned that? We need to be able to own our future when it comes to this digital layer. And I think we've got a lot of foundational work to do fast. And that being distracted by the, as you say, the shiny itis at a global scale, at a continental scale, could actually be a mistake. So I'm always very skeptical about leadership who thinks the solution for South Africa is to build a smart city. No, it's not. It's to fill the potholes right here in the real city that you've already got for the real people who are driving to work and trying to earn a living, right? So I always like think, I'm a futurist, but you don't get to the future unless you built a strong foundation.
Sure.
And leapfrogging into a future blindfolded, not having a clear indication of who's controlling things, where power dynamics are, is, I think, quite dangerous. But I don't know, I'm being a bit of a downer. Sharon, you can cheer people up.
No, I think we... Yeah, I'm
like, feed the babies first. Don't talk to me about iPads, you know, and classrooms.
Coming last when everyone said everything they used to say. But the point for me is that we've got to solve the right problems with the right solutions. Yes. And digital solutions aren't necessarily the only solutions. And I think that's where I at some point think there will be a tipping point. I don't know that digitization and smartness are going to sustain our bodies, you know, who just cannot process as much information and as much stuff as we try to fit into our kids' curriculums. And, you know, like, it just, our brains will implode, or unless evolution is real and, you know, we start to evolve our brains that become chips, or Musk does something with them for us. But the reality is, I think that there's something unique in the value of production. And to Bron's earlier point, like, we export and import stuff of value as opposed to creating the value internally ourselves. And I think at some point we've just got to turn the tables back. I think education has to shift. Yes, access to education, literacy, et cetera, et cetera. But from a solutionist perspective, you know, we can create an economy by leveraging the skills that we have in the youth, which may or may not include digitization and technology. I don't think you can ignore it either. Like, it's here. It's not going anywhere. But we have to start to think differently. Now, when are we going to bring apprenticeship colleges together? There's something inherent in design. My brother happened to have been one of PPC's last intakes of fitters and turners, and he could literally fix any problem on any machine for any reason. And yes, he wasn't a coder, but some of those basic skills are the things that actually we need today, and we killed them. So, yeah, I think if we can combine design with the tech, with the identification of the right problem and then the right solution, we have a chance at winning beyond all this commercial bullshit.
The good news is Africa's actual value is real. The rest of the world's wealth is based on nonsense. It's based on financialization and moving paperwork around, moving money around. We still have real value here, and that's a very attractive proposition for a hungry, barren, unfertile rest of the world. And I'm talking very literally in terms of children, in terms of land, in terms of
minerals,
in terms of real stuff is here. And we should just be very careful not to sell it off at a discount to people who are very happy to take ownership of that.
Yeah. And also not to be bullied. I think one of the big things that really concerns me, you know, within Conscious Leaders, we really take things very seriously. Like I always say, it's a democracy. We all decide what happens in this community. And one of the things that was interesting for me, so one of the trends that we started seeing is shareholder activism that is happening. And it's quite intense and very, very strongly happening. And just in our community, when women invest in shares, they go and put your sustainability report, your annual reports, not just one, into the system, into ChatGPT, and then say, here's all of my values. Now I want you to tell me which is the best companies to invest in, and try this. I mean, I tried it with a bank the other day, and the bank score came 5 out of 10. And that is the bank that I'm banking with. And we haven't even started with agentic AI when we are going to start transacting with our consumers. We are not going to be transacting with our consumers. Listen to me. We're going to be transacting with the consumer's agentic AI. So it's going to be AI communicating with AI. And what this is going to do for us is that we are going to get back to what it means to being human. Right? The analog renaissance, which we also monitor, which is fascinating and exciting. But at the same time, is businesses are going to have to completely upend, throw out the blueprints that we've always been using, because there is a rising that is happening underneath that you can't find online, because everybody's going off offline because they're not trusting what's happening online. And when you start listening to the conversations happening offline, it's very different to what's online. And there's two things when we monitor trends as well, is we look at free behavior and considered behavior. And free behavior is where you search things where nobody's looking what you're searching. But the considered behavior is when you go on that social media platform and you say things that you know your boss needs you to say. But it's all about smoke and mirrors. And we are witnessing a tennis ball effect of what is happening in society, because we're ignorantly making decisions about the future. And I don't know if I'm the only one feeling this, but I'm getting very concerned how little we know when we download an app or when we're engaging with technology. Because I study patents. I go and look at patents. I want to understand where they're rooted. What is the agendas of the shareholders? Because when you understand that, you go into the deep state of capitalism, and then you start understanding what they're coming for in Africa. And so we need to be very, very smart. And we all have access to this tool, AI, that can help us to understand where the future is going. Use it to do research. And this is what's fascinating. Yesterday, OpenAI revealed over 700 million users were studied, how they use ChatGPT. And what came out, research is one of the biggest ways of how people are using it now. So I don't think organizations are ready. I don't think they realize how they are being researched as well. So, yeah, I want to move into the trust. Trust is the currency of the 21st century. And if we want to build a future and build bridges to the future, we need trust. Because right now, this world is fear-based, and with fear, you build walls. So with trust in institutions, data, and even leaders at all-time low, how do we rebuild trust as the foundation for innovation and meaningful progress in Africa's AI journey. So I'm going to start this out so we can get to Karina and we can get to your input.
Because we're talking trust, I'd like to hear from her first.
Okay. All right. Let's go. I just don't want to confuse the panel. Okay. All right. Everyone's looking at me. I'm like, okay.
No, you're good.
Go for it.
Transparency, accountability, and inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
If we do those three things correctly, we will be able to take people on the journey with us. And that is how we will build trust. So we've seen, like I was saying earlier, where there are societies that have got higher levels of trust in their institutions, you're seeing much higher adoption levels for AI and other new technologies. But where you've got low trust, you're seeing the opposite. And we know that innovation, all of these things we're talking about, is tied to progress, which we want for everybody. So I think it's really important that when we create that environment, we're able to really just respond to what's going on in society. And then everybody kind of is coming on, you know, is on the same journey. And then we can introduce these technologies very safely. And that's the priority. Yeah.
Like they want. I think for me, I mean, it's quite similar. And I like the succinctness of threes that you gave. I think just putting AI aside, it's just what creates a healthy and safe working environment, right? It's like, do you feel that you can share? Do you feel that you can fail,
yeah,
right? Do you feel that you can grow? And environments that foster that lead to happier employees, better employees, more profitable businesses. And that's the foundation of trust, is the foundation of care. The tool and AI and adoption and scale, that's secondary to me. I think it's about creating environments, especially now where our teams and our employees are not just considered cogs in a wheel and machines or employee numbers, where they're feeling they're meaningfully contributing to the bigger picture of what we're trying to build. That leads to successful organizations more than it is the most digitally transformed organizations, which I think matters less. But yeah, I echo the sentiments deeply.
I've got a lot to say on this, but I won't. In fact, I was inspired by last year's Alderman Trust Barometer, which Richard spoke about, how the new word entered the chat being grievance, this idea that the more I give, the less I get, that the whole trust is broken down, whether you're talking about the relationship between employers and employees or citizens and the state or customers and companies. And that's like at the crux of this breakdown in trust, this idea that my government takes money and they don't fix the potholes. I show up at work and I don't get the promotion, right? Or I pay this person to come to work and they do their nails. They don't answer the phone. Like, no one is getting what they're giving. And that sort of breakdown that actually became my most booked keynote speech of this year. It was great. Greater than the sum, talking about this exact issue. But that's the issue. The issue is exactly the issue that we're trying to talk about in our book, this idea of being a solutionist. Trust breaks down when people are in the game to extract rather than to give value, right? And if you want to solve the problem, you have to make the first step. Like my favorite Terry Pratchett quotes, it's not your fault, it is your responsibility. Mm. And the way to fix this is to do the solutionist movement, which is to show up and add value. Unashamedly, unapologetically, instead of the way we're teaching our children. We're encouraging inadvertently our employees to show up and extract as much as possible. Mm. I mean, the most dramatic examples, they're actually in the consumer space, where 46% of Gen Z customers think it's okay to steal from a company. Sit with that for a second.
Wow.
And how many?
Because companies take more than they give, so I can steal from them. No problem.
Sure.
But that mindset applied to everything is this idea of, I'm not showing up to add value. I'm not showing up to play fair. I'm showing up to take. And this is what we get. So, you know, you need to become a solutionist. Join the movement.
Yeah. But I do think it's bigger than that. I think, you know, Mashami, you've chatted a bit about culture and about practice. And I think, the reality is that, you know, if you're a smoker and you're walking outside and having a cigarette, you're in some way stealing time, right? Unless that break is so necessary, you automatically become more productive at doing something in an organization. I think the reality is that we have AI has the potential, and digital technology, all of that stuff has the potential to create learned helplessness, which is actually to teach you to extract more and more and more value. So if the AI can take the minutes, then I don't actually have to listen in this meeting.
Yeah.
Just read it afterwards. Yeah. So we really have to be careful about what we're perpetuating. I mean, yeah, cool. Sorry, Microsoft. Put Copilot in, but has it change the dynamic of people being able to think and have real conversations? Are we talking about the real things actually? And are we measuring the real stuff? So if you're in sales and you're being pushed to sell as many cars as possible, despite the fact that it's causing massive emission, you know, environmental breakdown or whatever the case may be, or if you're trying to sell as many of so many bank accounts so that you can get whatever incentive, despite the fact that the person you're selling it to doesn't need that at that cost, in fact, doesn't need a bank account at all because they've got a little box under their bed and they feel quite happy doing that, is we actually have to fundamentally flip the script around what we measure and what drives profit and value in organizations. And you'll see lots of examples of this. I always say, you know, even starting with boards, you know, to me, board members are in bullshit jobs because actually they are end of life. We think they know everything. They're actually trying to keep their careers going for life. So are they really asking the real questions? And who should we be asking? And I really think we need to flip the script around some of this stuff. I think we're tackling it from the wrong end, quite frankly.
So I want to open the floor for questions. I just want you to have the mic, David, so that we can have it in the podcast.
This is fascinating. A comment and then a question. An observation is what's happening here is a masterclass in the human condition. We really, really bad at doing what's necessary in favor of doing what's convenient.
Easy, exactly.
And so my question is for you, Sharon. You have just been appointed the Minister of Solutionist Advancement for Corporate South Africa.
It sounds like a bullshit job.
Potentially. We'll see if it's a bullshit job in the next 6 months. And you only have one task. There's no council. You have to confer with nobody. It's not a democracy. You are empowered to make the decision on your own. What one practical thing will you have corporate South Africa enact, not a spouse on a website, enact with proof within 6 months of your instruction to start the process of chucking a stick in the spokes of the status quo of this is how we've always done it, and we've got a board and and that's the reason we're not going to do it, although we want to. One practical thing, 6 months.
So I don't know. It's a bit of a loaded answer to a loaded question, because that was worse than being interviewed by Sam earlier. But I think my only message is, can we start to kill the bullshit? Can we find it and can we kill it? Anywhere where we are adding and passing on cost and extracting value from society, even if it means extracting a product, killing a branch, taking away a shitty process. I mean, you know, Uber Eats is a classic. You can't speak to a human, but you get refunded immediately if you have a complaint. Doesn't bring food to your door, doesn't change the order, doesn't stop your annoyance, but it's actually a fast, quick, easy, satisfying solution, and we have all come to accept. Can we all just go back to basics? That would be my ask.
Love that.
Okay, that's good enough. You're hired. All right. But we're not going to pay you, because we want you to be an above average person on a below average salary.
Okay,
is that
that's cool?
Cool.
Okay. But for all the money I save, you can put that in my bank account. You can let me.
That's no, that's not a problem. But that's just between you and I. Thank you.
I wanted to add something. For the past 3 years, I have not been driving to meetings. I've not been going to, you know, getting in my car and driving to places. But I'm actually doing research with Uber drivers, and have conversations with them, because I want to understand what's happening below the line and above the line. And it has really opened up my eyes into where
the different lenses are and how we all have these conversations and how far removed they are from what's happening in real life and how they perceive real life. And it worries me a lot because from boardroom to grassroots, there's such a disconnection. Mm-hmm. And how can we build for Africa if we can't bring those two worlds together? Mm-hmm. If we really want to drive the growth for Africa, why are we not doing something about that? Where we can start bringing in collaboration, we can bring different voices to the table, but not everybody has to be in a corporate position. One of the reasons I started Conscious Leaders is because these women in leadership movements and events and things are always happening for corporate women, but we're not seeing enough of them happening for us as entrepreneurs. And we also need to be part of that conversation because we are at grassroots levels. So that's not a question, but I think to what you were saying, David, I would also say to them to get out of the boardroom and to get to grassroots levels. If they really want to see change, they really have to get their hands dirty, their feet dirty, before they start demanding that from the entire world. You know, take them on an excursion, on a safari by feet into the real world.
Calm, just on that, like one of the things I always say is like, you know, got big corporates, whether it's a branch, whether it's a retail store, how many of the leaders have taken the 17 taxis it took to get there? How many of the leaders have people at home minding their kids and those same women have to go home whose kids are unattended and looked after? How many of us are hiring the wrong nature of skill or human to face off to advisory on something? If you've, I don't know, you've never had kids, but all of a sudden I'm trying to tell you how to robot-proof them. Like, we need to look at some of the stuff in corporates differently, like turn talent management on its head. Who's facing off to the customer? What does that customer look like? And can they have an honest conversation with him? Like, who are you hiring even? Who should you be hiring? We just aren't designing for this.
Yeah.
And it's time to stop.
Yeah. Oh, Mike, please.
I'm taking too much of this floor, I think.
Hold that question. And then I think we've got room for, what's the time now?
5:15.
I think we've got room for one more question, then we have to bring another speaker on.
Okay. On that note of, are we hiring the right people? And I think the motivation that I just got here in the room to say, go and be a solutionist. Now playing with the idea in my head to say, how do I then go back to the office and start questioning what the real problem is without being perceived as having a big head, especially being a black female in South Africa today?
Yes.
So how do we marry this ideology of being solutionist and still being a black female leader, challenging the patriarchy that exists in South Africa?
I think there are lots of ways. And if you look at the solutionist wheel at the back of the book, you'll see, I always believe data speaks, right? You've got to hit people where they can't argue.
Ooh.
And that is the critical piece. And
can we just give you a round of applause? I love that.
You can't have hypothetical, theoretical conversations like we're hiring the wrong people. Prove it. So what are you doing to show up in a way that leverages data and insight to make this stuff real? So if you're doing diversity stats that are compliance related because you need a triple BEE certificate and you need FSE scorecards and all that other BS, but you know fundamentally, and if you're doing planning well, that 200 people in your organization and lose their jobs because we're automating something or because our customer base is shrinking or because tariffs have caused a disaster, you know, how are you dealing the data to overcome that? I always focus on the data, right? Ask the questions, get the right answers, know what to do with them, and leverage data. I can see in job titles, if there are hundreds of double barrel job titles, like we have created structures around people. There's no real work here.
Yeah.
Like start to challenge the data. And when you come at them with data, Doesn't matter, black, white, pink, or yellow. The data is the data.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe another take on the data and the way that you shape the story.
Exactly.
Is in trying to get people to change and get them to evolve, sometimes you're pulling them, dragging, and kicking.
Give it to you.
Yeah, an easier way to get them to give it to you is by showing them the cost of not changing, right? This is the cost if we don't evolve. This is the cost if we keep doing it the same way. This is what you risk. Usually when you show leaders or peers that, or excos, mancos, whatever, that, it's an easier change process than just come with me because I know better, or because I'm the voice that you haven't heard. No, this is what I'm showing you. If you continue to stay the same, this is the risk that you'll put us at, or this is where our company will go. That's an easier way to take them through that journey.
It's about how you tell the story around the data, right? But you still need the data. Can't be hypothetical.
100%.
And data comes in many forms. And data can be manipulated.
Yeah.
And how many boards and exos ask you to go back and do the analysis again?
Until you
and
answer.
Go back and compare so that you can give them the answer they want to hear. You have to be able to do the right job of that data. And not all data is important. So cut the crap, basically, and then show them.
And if you want help, there's the free tools on our website.
Yeah.
You can take them through that process.
Or call and call us.
Yeah. They're free.
What's the value at stake, I guess, is the point, right?
I love that. Well asked. Do we have any more questions? Okay, so I think, first of all, before we close the panel, I want to ask Karina a question. I know we wanted to have you in the beginning because we ran out of time to do a five-minute session with us, but can you tell us, in terms of the solutionist movement and you know, becoming future fit, you know, what can we expect if we don't change the game of trust?
Thanks, Carmen. So look, I think we've trust is kind of part of our core as Edelman. So I can't honestly envisage a world where we don't have that and where we see it around us everywhere. We've been studying it now for 25 years. And that's also given us a chance to actually measure it. And we know that it matters now because we've been measuring it. So we know that trusted institutions, individuals, organizations, whatever you like, have more loyal customers. They've got more engaged employees. They perform better on the stock exchange. Sorry, profit. there's real measurement to what happens when you are trusted and then how that plays. So that trust capital and how you can use that to actually do the right thing. And when you look at how we actually test trust, and this is something that's on my mind a lot, is the question we ask people is, how much do you trust this institution to do the right thing? It's not any more complicated than that.
Yeah.
But from that, we can deduce very interesting insights. And I worry, and you didn't ask me this question, but I'm going to volunteer it, that I think we've lost sight of what's right and what's wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually heard a speaker last year in a wonderful conference, and also a futurist. She was talking about the roles, unexpected roles for people in the future, and how autistic children will one day be employed by organizations.
They honest.
Because they cannot tell a lie.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. At Focus. So, and all of the parents in the room who had children that were either neurodivergent or struggling with that actually became quite emotional because those children, as you were saying, didn't feel like they fitted in anywhere. Mm-hmm. And one day there will be plenty of places for those children. And that's a wonderful thing to think about. So I think it's really about saying, how do we really start to help build that trust capital? And we know from our research and the work that we do with our clients that when organizations take action, that's what earns the trust.
Yeah.
It's not about saying we're going to do this. We put on a website. We put out lovely, beautifully designed social media posts that tell stories about things that don't actually happen.
Yeah.
Action is going to earn the trust, and trust is going to drive growth ultimately.
Yeah. Yeah. And also just to add to that point, I also believe that what we're seeing in the world is a lot of trust engineering.
Mm. Yeah.
And authenticity as a performance rather than actually doing the right thing and being trustworthy.
Yeah.
So I totally agree with that. And I'm so excited about what you've just shared because, yo, that's exciting news. fun fact, there was actually a study that was done with autistic children and they found that they, it's called the telepathy tapes. You got to listen to it, where these children in completely different countries can actually communicate with each other via telepathy.
Oh.
And they have these special gifts, but it's a specific type of autism. And I thought to myself, these kids are going to teach us things in the future. We're AI, when they want to control our thoughts with AI, we actually have those capabilities as humanity, and we just have to relearn that. I mean, that gets me very excited. Authentic intelligence, hashtag, just saying. all right, final thoughts from the panel. I think I'm going to start with Sharon over there, and then we move our way to Mashambi.
I don't have any final thoughts other than join the solutionist movement, guys. Like, we have to teach people to think differently and behave differently. And, to Karina's point, trust is earned. Good news isn't something to be rewarded. You got to know where the BS is.
Mm. Yeah, I think just basically what Sharon's saying, but be ruthless in unearthing the value that you're bringing or not, in assessing where your mess and where your value is, and focusing on actually bringing something to the table, to trade with, to play with, to build the economies that we want, yeah, for our country, for our continent, for future generations.
I think from a communications angle, I think it's really about misinformation, disinformation. Mm. I think that's why these dialogues are so important. I think the more we talk about this and debate different perspectives, even though they might feel contradictory, the more we're equipping ourselves to understand and then make decisions for ourselves. Yeah.
Totally.
We were laughing about it actually in the other room. The title of my book, When I Don't Need Any More Clients, is going to be The Bar Is Low. and I think that maybe probably quite soon, the way I keep talking about it, but I think the standard for excellence, performance, success, growth in service, just quality in so many large organizations and logos that we love, and countries that we might love, when you look under the hood, it's shocking. And I've seen that time and time and time again. And so I think that the standard for growth shouldn't be pegged on everyone else and everywhere else. I think we've got so much excellence within ourselves. And if we take ownership of that, we'll see, and then we can truly fly. So join the adaptable
movement.
But the adaptable solutionist movement. Yeah.
Listen, this is what I mean, what did you say the other day, Pietri, about the bubbles? We have to create islands of sanity in all our worlds, all our movements. We are moving into the era of movements. You're going to see many movements erupting from everywhere. And we all have to just start joining hands and our worlds will come together and collide. And that's why we are having these conversations. I think my call to action to all of you is to reassess your own values. Businesses, reassess your values. Go back to the drawing boards. Is your value still aligned with the times that we are moving into? And I think once you can understand your own values, you can design a world where you can bring value. But if you're trying to bring value to a world that is falling apart or the system is not working, then it's not going to work. All right. Thank you so much for everybody that has joined us. Come and have a glass of wine. Come have some food and let's mingle. I love that all of you have taken time to be here. And thank you for being part of Conscious Leaders. And men are welcome in our community. We welcome you. We want your voices. We want to hear what you have to say, because that is the thing. All the ladies always go, men never want to listen to us and what we have to say. I said, well, not here. Here we have robust conversations because everyone is welcome. Human empowerment, responsibility, and sustainability. Thank you so much and hope to see you at the next one. Bye-bye now.